Have you ever found yourself impaled on the horns of a dilemma, caught in the crossfire of confusion between pride and prejudice, or simply sinking in a quagmire of moral imperatives and secret desires? To your aid comes The Ethicist. He doesn't make house calls, but he does come to you weekly in a column in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Now, those who'd like a bit more of Randy Cohen's prescriptions, a sort of cross between Benjamin Franklin and Ann Landers, can find it in his new book, The Good, the Bad, and the Difference. Randy Cohen joins us now. Why don't we begin just a little bit about being approached to be an ethicist? This is not a position one would think to find, you know, quite given this sort of platform in modern life outside of a pulpit. So how did this come about?
Nora, if you were looking for such a person, would you look in my apartment where ethicists are very thin on the ground? I'm entirely an accidental ethicist. The idea for the column originated in-house at the New York Times Magazine, and they invited four or five people to audition for the job. We were each given the same three cunning scenarios, rich with ethical complexity, and asked to write an answer.
Can you recall what one of those was?
I can, actually. It was, you're passing a colleague's desk, and on her computer terminal, you see an email, and it's about you. And it's blaming the failure of a recent project, quite unjustly, on you. How do you respond? Very cunning, I thought, because you ought not be reading someone else's email. But if you could stop yourself when you saw your own name, I don't think that shows an excess of ethics. It shows a lack of vitality. How could you not be curious? But you can't let on that you've done such a wicked thing.
So what was your answer?
A preemptive memo. It sounds like a Dilbert line, doesn't it? It was write your own note to your boss, suggesting we re-examine the failure of the Johnson Project and look into how we can all do better. Don't blame anyone. Don't acknowledge that you've read the email. Be positive.
I'm making notes here, Randy.
So you have been prying. I think it shows a healthy curiosity on your part.
I wouldn't want to, you know, further my air by being slothful. How about prepping for this? I mean, obviously you've sat down with the great works of Thomas Aquinas and Plato.
A better person than I would no doubt have immediately begun the process of remedial education, which I failed to do. Instead, I've turned to people who, in fact, are sophisticated. I've now built up a sort of kitchen cabinet. There's a variety of wonderful, sophisticated people who are far better informed than I that I can now turn to. So, for instance, if it's a question about medicine, there's a wonderful medical ethicist at the AMA that I can call up, and she'll explain first what the actual medical procedure is and then what the AMA's line on medical ethics is, which I may find to be, you know, dreadful, but it's important that I know what it is before I start mocking it and deriding it. So it's really taking advantage of my betters that's let me have this cushy job.
Well, I think what you also take advantage of is while you often, I think, 90% of the time, give excellent advice and soul-searching and a good disquisition on this stuff, it's funny. And you were a comedy writer before you did this. You wrote for David Letterman, the head writer.
Yeah, I spent 7 years at the Letterman show, 950 shows. It seemed vulgar to go for four digits. it seems an unlikely kind of background for someone who's now writing about ethics, but I'd put it to you that it's not as odd as you might think, that it seems to me that what Dave was up to was an essentially moral enterprise. All comedy attacks, or most comedy attacks, and the interesting ethical question is, whom do you attack, and why do you attack them? And I thought a guideline on our show was that you only attack people for what's volitional, for what they choose to do. If someone deliberately goes out and is a bad actor, that's fair game. But you don't attack them for things over which they have no control. You don't attack someone for having a big, ugly nose.
Okay, you've divided this into civic, family, social life, commercial life, medical, work, and school life. But let's, would you mind if we did a bit of ethicists Q&A here?
I'd be delighted.
All right. I'll play the role of the beseeching supplicant, okay?
What humility you bring to it. I feel like we're at Lourdes.
I'm on my knees. Dear ethicist, I'm having a little trouble with the following 10 points. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make into thee any graven image. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, of course, we're not making fun of the Ten Commandments, but you do point out that many people want this posted on the doors or walls of a classroom. Why not?
The Ten Commandments are an interesting thing to look at. And one of the things I have a chance to do in the book that I don't get to do in the column, which is just Q&A, is to look at the moral foundations that I draw on to make my own decisions and also to examine the ethical guidelines other people use. And certainly the most frequent reference for the people that write to me, at least, is the religious faith they grew up in. And within that, the most familiar set of ethical guidelines is certainly the Ten Commandments, which strikes me as a very unlikely guideline, especially for children. If you look at them, the first four, the ones that you read, are entirely about God, God talking about himself. You know, it's just me, me, me. You'd think if he were God, he'd have a little more self-confidence. So now we're down to only six. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, how often will that come up in the third grade? You know, so few of those children are married. Now we're down, what are we down to? I've lost the ability to do math. Now we're down to five. You know, thou shalt not murder. Okay, now that's good. But again, do we really need to be told that? And as you work through the commandments, you'll see the reason I believe there's an eagerness to post them on the walls of the school can't be to instruct. We all know, really, even the wicked kids know, the tough kids, the kids that gave us a hard time, they really know they shouldn't be murdering us. So perhaps the reason those who want the commandments posted want to do so, not to educate, but as a symbol, the same way the flag is posted, the same way a picture of George Washington is posted, because it's symbolic of a certain way of life.
What's your favorite kind of question to answer?
Oh, the ones where I instantly know a clever retort, of course. I can tell you the most common question, or at least the question that the reader seemed to ask the most, which is one variation or another on, do you tell someone in your office who's swiping office supplies, a neighbor who's cheating on his taxes, or the hardest of the hard, you know that your best friend's spouse is cheating. Do you tell your friend?
And what is your counsel?
Well, it's certainly a hard question because it gets back to, I think, the particular nature of certain relationships, in this case, friendship. If you don't tell, you're conspiring to deceive your friend. That's an awful thing to do. If you do tell, you're messing about in the most intimate part of someone's life. Here's my guideline is, your ethical obligation is to help your friend here, and what would serve your friend's happiness? So some people want to know, some people don't. If you're confident your friend wants to know, tell. If you're not sure your friend wants to know, don't tell. But how do you know? How do you know what your friend wants?
I think you might have a future in this. Very good.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you so much for this discussion. We really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure for me.